Hi, this is Jeff from Wilco, and you're listening to KWVA Eugene.
Baby, come on out tonight, Cadillac shining bright. I found rockabilly on my radio.
Hey, cats and kittens, looking for rockabilly on the radio? This is Johnny Now inviting you to tune into the Nowlesville Show, 3 to 6 p.m. Saturday afternoons on KWVA 88.1 FM.
It's now.
The views expressed on this program are not necessarily the views of KWVA Radio or the Associated Students of the University of Oregon. Anarchy Radio is an editorial collage providing analysis and opinions of John Zerzan and the community at large.
Comes up.
September 18th, Anarchy Radio. Okie dokie. I think we're going to have Ant toward the end of the show give a kind of response to something that was addressed here in Eugene a couple of months ago or so. I think that's going to be good. I think we can fit that in. Might have Danielle next week from Venezuela via Puerto Rico. He's back, so we just might do that. And it turns out I don't have to skip the show in order to catch the Caveman sitcom on ABC. It hasn't even started yet. I was thinking it was last 8 to 9 p.m. on Tuesday last week, but definitely waiting for that. Waiting for the further rollout of primitivism into into mainstream TV. Oh, I'm sure it's going to be good. All right, we are on the internet at kwvaradio.org and archived at archive.org. And call in 346-0645, area code 541. The country code, when we do have people that listen in other places, other countries, I think it's 01, but I'm actually not sure about that. I just thought of that. This is something I want to throw out. Maybe it won't be the first time I'm throwing it out. Seeking Connections. Yeah, after this, the 10-country European tour that Catherine and I did about 3 months ago now, already fantasizing, and maybe with Kevin Tucker sometime in 08, maybe pretty soon, I don't know, but we're trying to get stuff together. I've mentioned some different countries and some possible, well, some real connections, but as far as putting together some kind of tour or something, we'll see. I think something will happen. But so if you know people, or if you are one of those people in some other place and you're interested in that, let me know. Let's get in touch, and maybe we can start piecing this together. Well, one place, I did mention this before, I think just last time, from the Philippines, an anti-civilization group with the zine, I think it's the same name, Erva Daninya, I think that's how you say it. And I was guessing that it's a kind of anti-domestication plant, and I was just kind of reaching for that one, but I just got an email about that, and they said, hola, yes, Erva Daninya, it's not that hard, but anyway, is any plant that attacks domestication a plant that cannot be controlled and that spreads, adapting to diverse environments, widening the concrete fractures, and some other stuff, but that's the key thing there. And just today, I heard from a friend of mine in Andalusia, in Spain. And this is about a point that I've thrown out before, kind of interesting. He says, speaking of possible destinations, I just asked a couple of friends from Granada and Caceres. I think Granada is an important place for a talk. There are many young anarchists with ideas close to primitivism, and many self-managed collectivities in the surrounding towns. Also, Caceres could be of interest. There's a strong ecologist movement, and the CNT is very open-minded. And he goes on to say that the future director of the CNT newspaper in one of these places is an anthropologist. And CNT is very potent in these areas. I definitely got that read when I was there last year. And it's just cool to see that there doesn't have to be this this feud that kind of rehearses the same arguments over and over. I'm talking about syndicalists in this country, in North America, in general. And these are, you know, CNT, syndicalist, militant unionism there. But they wanted to host these discussions and so forth, and they did. And now they're into more of that. And so you've got a good range of stuff, and that makes for good dialogue. And there are things going on. It seemed extremely healthy and fun to be there. When was that? Last June, I guess it was. Well, some of the news, middle of last week, this is a little more on Chile, roughly having to do with the coup anniversary, the overthrow of Allende way back in 73. Middle of last week, battles between police and gun-wielding attackers, as they're called, erupted in several Santiago neighborhoods with some assailants reportedly using automatic weapons and sophisticated laser sighting mechanisms against police during one of these conflicts. Officer Christian Vera received a bullet wound to the head. He was rushed to a nearby hospital where he's pronounced dead. Last Wednesday, another 42 cops were wounded that evening and thousands of dollars worth of property destroyed. Again, it had to do with the commemorating the anniversary of the military coup in Chile in 73. Started out as a relatively tranquil protest. Bangladesh, this is ongoing. This is it's been going on for a while, too. The garment workers in Dhaka and I think some other cities. Yesterday, more clashes, fighting broke out. This is just, they cannot seem to control this, and these factories have been stopped, and no matter what kind of official agreements have been reached, they are not reaching down to stop the militancy there. I think last week I said something about 1,000 mink were liberated in the ALF thing last time. This was in Sweden. Well, here's another one. Here's one of the winners ALF-wise this week. As many as 6,000 mink were released from cages early Saturday. This was last week at a fur farm near Harcourt, a town on the east coast of Newfoundland. Yeah, big mink factory there, 6,000 or so. Here's something. I'm not going to go through lots of random news. This is kind of a strange thing. Summer had their crime think get together in Athens, Ohio, and they said it was over 300, which was quite a bit bigger than last year's. And they gave quite a report. I read this on InfoShop in terms of some of the things that went on. But it's kind of strange. This struck me as the strangest part. The biggest draw, evidently, was a workshop on the Maya calendar, you know, the 2012 end of the world nonsense. It's just, you know, I don't know. And they're kind of scratching their heads as to why. Was that just a novelty? Were people kind of like laughing? Or were people just way into this kind of millenarian, the latest kind of thing like that? So anyway, you could check that out on InfoShop. I wasn't sure what to make of it. But they did have a lot more people, and there were a lot of things going on besides the Maya calendar. Well, I happened to spend a little time today with my friend Aragorn, one of the editors of Anarchy Magazine. He was coming through town. He'd just come down from Canada, and he was very up about what was going on up there. They just opened an info shop in Victoria, had quite a big book fair that was very well organized. And the main thing I want to bring up right now, since I have in my hands this catalog, this is a project only 2 months old now called Little Black Cart. It's a distro thing out of Berkeley. Little Black Cart. You can just go to littleblackcart.com. They have a P.O. Box, too. P.O. Box 3920 in Berkeley, 94703. This is really amazing how ambitious this is and how already it's getting way off the ground. In 2 months, they had a very strong showing there. Lots of interest. On at least one of the two main days, they outdid AK Press, and that's kind of the mega marketeer, the mega anarchist. Well, it's not only a distro, it's of course a publishing house, and I've talked about them before, but very cool catalog, very nicely put together, and most importantly, what they have on offer, and they're still growing. This is really wise. I think this is a way of drawing these things together and making them much more easily available. They're also talking about putting out a free tabloid kind of a thing, which is just reviews, so that everyone can get some kind of hit about the things that are coming out now in terms of new books and zines and videos and like that. And I think that's maybe a couple of months away. I'm not too sure about that. Now, we've had some disagreements or differences of emphasis. The current issue, it looks so good. It's largely about capitalism, and some of us have said, "Oh, capitalism, that's a little, isn't that a little stale? Is there anything new to say about that?" You know. And the next one, apparently, and I didn't hear this from Aragorn, but the next topic is imperialism. Yeah, in this post-leftist world, you know, we didn't really have time to get into that argument again, but I don't know. Is that really, we need to hash that over again? Meanwhile, here's a shot. Speaking of post-leftism, beginning of November in Montpelier, Vermont, the Renewing the Anarchist Tradition Conference is happening, and a friend of mine who used to live here, he just moved away. He's a philosophy grad student and anarchist. Very interesting guy. Presented a proposal. I talked about this in passing, having to do with Heidegger and myself and some other things along those lines. And making the argument, renewal, you know, bringing things up to date. We've got to talk about new things. We've got to talk about the technology question and so forth. And I said to him, it'll be a very warm day somewhere when RAT, Renewing the Anarchist Tradition, it should be called, I think, Retrenching the Anarchist Dogma or something like that. Unfortunately, they're just not open to it. They're just not open to it. And I said, I hope I'm wrong. You know, I hope they go, yeah, sure, do the workshop. Cool, you know. Well, the proposal, the deadline was September 1st, and what are we, the 18th now, and he hasn't heard nothing, so, yeah, that's kind of typical. Why call it that? Or like, AK, why say you're so open and you don't, and you publish all kinds of stuff you disagree with, when there are just glaring examples of, that's false as a statement. Okay, let's get right to the ad of the week. I got a couple of things here. Look at this, Carl, check this out. This is,
That's a hippie.
It's a caveman, man. You know what I'm saying. The New York Times Magazine every once in a while does this great big fat kind of GQ fashion thing. This is men's fashion. Mm-hmm. What I'm holding here is a picture of a guy looking very suave in this probably $500 jacket. It says Weatherproof Garment Company since 1948. And the 1948 is crossed out. It says 1 million BC. And the strange thing about this cool and hip guy is he's got the face of a caveman. That's really, so I don't know. I just thought.
Yeah, I feel weird about that.
Isn't that strange? Caveman everywhere, huh? It's not the ad of the week. You know, I just thought it was pretty kooky. I got two real candidates here for you. One of them isn't exactly an ad. I think I'll do that one first. And thank you to Josh Ludd. Good old Joshua sent this in. It's not an ad. He says, I don't know if you saw it, but Russia announced that they had tested the largest bomb ever created last week, and it wasn't a nuclear bomb. And part of the statement about it was that, in terms of weapons, it is environmentally friendly. environmentally friendly, biggest bomb ever made, except for the H-bomb or something. And, oh, yeah, it's probably green and sustainable. Yeah, that's just great. Okay, but here's the real one, ad-wise. TV commercial for waste management. I don't even know where this is from. This might be Seattle. I don't know. WM is not known to me around here anyway. Anyway, this is great. It shows this big garbage truck driving through the forest. And it's soundless, you know, big garbage trucks don't make any noise. And the birds are flying. It looks like it's kind of roughly led by doves or something. It's all out in the wilderness. So you wonder whose garbage are they picking up, or, you know, what are they doing out there? And it says 41 million trees, or equal to 41 million trees, the amount of last year's recycling. So, well, a couple of things. First of all, it's just a given that there would be so much stuff to recycle, but as if it's this soundless vehicle kind of wafting along through the trees, you know, it's strange. It doesn't take any energy, you know, it doesn't even make any noise, and it's just kind of almost flying. And anyway, just more screwy the way they can package all this stuff, and I mean, my point isn't anti-recycling, but it's just, they just dress it all up. It's the answer to everything, and nobody wants to get down to what it really adds up to, such as making room for more production. And, you know, and in some cases, I've seen these studies that say, in many cases, it takes more energy. All of the inputs to do all that stuff, you could just leave it, and you would be producing less CO2 and everything else. Anyway, let's just go on here. Now, this is something maybe this falls under all too obvious, but, you know, in this country especially, and not only this country, but spectator sports, passively consumed sports is a religion, or if not the religion of mass society. It's just so, I mean, it's a banality. Everybody knows that. Well, it's just, there's more and more and more of the same thing in every single sport that's consumed. We're not talking about people doing stuff, you know, we're talking about people sitting there watching it on TV, essentially. The coach of the New England Patriots, and it's kind of like that team in the National Football League in itself is kind of wrapped in this whole, you know, all-American thing. Huge, huge penalty. It turns out they were spying on other teams. Malcolm McLaren of the Formula One, Ron Dennis, the director of McLaren Mercedes, fined $100 million for spying. I mean, there's nothing, there isn't any of these sports. It isn't just completely, Barry Bonds, the home run record, Mr. Steroid, the French cycling team, we were mentioning this before, in the Tour de France, completely doped up. Michael Vick, the football star, quarterback, dogfighting, the National Basketball Association refs at game-fixing scandals, track and field rife with all these, quote, performance-enhancing drugs. Can't name a sport, just cannot. The Olympics not excluded. It's just, gee, whatever happened to... I mean, even that is just rotting. It's just decomposing, which is, by the way, it's a link to another striking case of the decomposition so rampant in mass culture, and that's O.J. Simpson. And, of course, for the last 3 days, it's been 24 hours a day. O.J. Simpson.
Yeah, can't get away from it.
Oh, I know.
It's like I traveled back in time.
There, you can't get away. Yeah, here we are again. Some tawdry hotel room deal in Las Vegas. Who the hell cares?
It's amazing. Like, what was he, like, supposedly, I heard he was facing, like, 200 years or something.
Oh,
with all
these
the
felonies
counts.
They piled on.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, nothing's ever happened to him, so he doesn't even have the brains to keep his mouth shut. He's nailed himself. But of course, you know, when you got Anna Nicole Smith, and who is the talentless singer back in the endless... I can never think of her name. Sort of like a Madonna, but much more new, much more awful.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, it can't be more awful than Madonna,
Britney Spears.
Britney Spears, yeah. You can, yeah. And even these mainstream people that were never nothing to begin with, but even they are embarrassed having to sit there and talk about it, interview these people, these creepy people with nothing going on. It just, you know, check it out. How we're not far from the collapse of this whole. It's just, you know, too far gone, it seems to me. Well, and that's, everybody knows this stuff, but when you start looking at it, like, well, gee, it's just a complete pattern. It's just a deepening phenomenon, and that's just an example of the sports thing or the pop culture thing. It could hardly be dumber. Well, here's one that's sort of dumber. Well, that'll lead into something else. Why don't we take a break now and kind of get ahead of the game a little bit. A little music, be right back. 3460645.
Literacy is not just the ability to read. Literacy fires the imagination, enriches the mind, and teaches values. Read to your children, and they'll enjoy books for a day. Teach them to read, and they'll enjoy books for a lifetime.
And that is a story.
Hi, I'm Malene Walden.
My husband, Congressman Greg Walden, and I urge you to read with your children, because literacy is a gift for life.
This message brought to you by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
For free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I want money. That's what I want. That's what I want. That's what I want. Your love gives me such a thrill, but your love won't pay my bills. I want money. Everything, it's true. What it don't get, I can't use. I want money.
Hello. Okay, we got some technology stuff here. This is a great one. Just came in today. Chinese man drops dead after a three-day gaming binge in China. Been playing games online for 3 days. He dropped dead. He just yes, internet addiction. Anybody? Here's something in the New York Times also today. Kind of interesting there. This is the fourth annual Conflux, a festival in Brooklyn. And apparently largely inspired by the psychogeography concept of Guy Debord. It goes way back to the mid-50s. It has to do with how environment influences people, also sometimes expressed in the practice called derive or drift, where people, as a kind of experiment or as a way of trying to cross through boundaries, would just sort of drift or wander wherever things took them. In Paris, for example, and that was a kind of exercise, and I think it's harder to pull off these days. I mean, but I can think of, and Debord himself had a kind of broken heart starting in the 70s with what was happening with Paris, you know, these very interesting old, even medieval neighborhoods were just wiped out, and so drifting around through those wasn't, there we go, that wonderful surveillance thing just beeping like crazy 2 feet from the mics here. So, anyway... This is the first time I've read about this. The first review. I've certainly never been a part of any of these Conflux gatherings, but quite a write-up, all about how immersed the whole thing now is in technology. It's all I don't know, it's just all monitored and commented upon and acted out through all the new gizmos, all the different kinds of technological mediation. It shows a picture of free power for all their cell phones and MP3s and everything else. And it sounds like some of this is critical, and some of the, they're pointing out surveillance, they're pointing out some of the excess of some of the of what's going on in the deepening technosphere as the technology becomes more pervasive and defining, but it also just seems to be drowning what was a kind of natural or spontaneous unmediated wandering around, especially the drift, as I was mentioning from Debord, and this is you know, taking place in Brooklyn right now. But anyway, there were some interesting parts. Let me just read a little bit of this here. A duo called, and there are lots of different people, projects in part, or part of this, so there's no way to just quickly summarize it all, put it under one label. But, for example, a duo called Public Domestications, love the title, created a little street library, a school desk chained to a lamppost holding miniature books by Rudyard Kipling and so forth. It met with the worst fate of street art. It was torched on Friday night. Somebody didn't like the art. Or they didn't like the comment on education or something, who knows. And then it says, in a more anarchist vein, Lucas Murgida offered, quote, the Locksmithing Institute of Conflicts, which provided instruction on how to pick locks, including those on handcuffs. So, but it sounds like the thing is getting engulfed by technology, and that's just what isn't. Maybe here's a little antidote. This is actually from the CBS News, the network news, one day last week. A little segment on autism and how some people have discovered, and it sounds like pretty effective. It sounds like not just you know, it's just some sort of exception. Bringing children to the ocean and actually surfing with them more particularly, and how healing that is. And it just makes you think maybe that's far more than just a metaphor about nature and kids adrift and being prey to autism, being prey to something that's about turning off to the whole symbolic atmosphere. I think that's valid as one way of describing it, and that doesn't describe how it comes about specifically, of course, but I thought that was wonderful. A lot of these kids just completely start smiling and you know, coming out of that, and it's just being in the ocean. Quite amazing. There, actually, if anybody's interested in that, there's a website called Surfers Healing about autism resources, and that one in particular. Well, I certainly brought up the question of Second Life, having written something about it, which I read, 2 weeks ago, I think. And every day, this is just completely swamping the place. There's nowhere you can turn without, I could always... foreseeably anyway, start commenting on every article and all the different takes, which are all too similar, sadly enough. But here's an interesting one. Lots of stuff in the New York Times today I found interesting. In the arts and entertainment sort of section, the music section actually, here's a piece called Watching a Cyber Audience Watch a Real Orchestra Perform in a Virtual World. And I think I've read this twice, and I can't even sort it out. It's so bizarre. It's just so, it is a virtual environment in the online, you know, Second Life thing, Second Life world, in a virtual replica of the Art Deco world in Liverpool, where the audience is, as it says, the it's a cyber audience, which means the people are, or what is called avatars, these animated figures, the self-representation of people who are in Second Life. And they're watching an orchestra perform live in a choppy video streamed over the internet on a screen. And I don't know, the whole thing is just, they seem to want to come up with new levels of taking it away from experiencing anything in some more or less direct way. Yeah, it's just kind of wacky. It's just got to be streamed, and then it's fed into the virtual world where the people who are listening aren't people, and it's quite amazing. You might have to be some kind of clever novelist to even set this up, even propose such a thing, I think. Yeah, I just have kind of a handful of tech things that seem to be kind of sort of a piece. Well, and here's another one, and these things are no secret whatsoever. This is from Parade magazine, that staple of every Sunday newspapers, syndicated kind of fluff kind of thing. But here's an article: Is anything private anymore? In our digital world, it may be impossible to protect personal information. They point out certain things, like such the fact that data, whatever it is, information, images, all of it is permanent. And they're virtually saying this ain't going away, and this just the nature of the game, and it's the nature of reality. It's, it isn't even one of these pieces that say, oh, it's going too far, we can't have this, and wringing their hands or washing their hands and providing no real critique or no real mode of attack or anything else. But this one just is even further along. It just says, for example, it says, one of the headline things, we can't turn back the clock. It just keeps going along that way. It's just awful, and it's too late, and your life is just, there's a camera in your toilet, or, virtually, that sort of thing. Not to use the word virtually. And Sunday, this is just another little piece of it, I guess. Hewlett-Packard has unveiled a new TouchSmart IQ770 PC, which is strictly designed for the kitchen. So you can't get away from it anywhere. It's all rigged up so that it's at the height of the all the kitchen appliances. You can stand there and stir, but you can't just stand there and cook or pay attention to that. You got to be online and surfing and all that. It's pretty darn predictable. And here's another one, and just also in the last couple of days. And really, what goes along with Second Life, I think, in many respects, as well as just the general techno respect, is robotics. That turning toward simulation, and what I'm talking about specifically, a piece in the Weekend called "Inventor Builds Artificial Boy," and this has to do with what are called social robots. They're interactive, not in the way of something in cyberspace on a screen, but they're physical robots. There's one shown in this article. A robot called Zeno. It learns your name and can build a relationship with you. Yeah, and this is nothing new. Of course, it's just now it's just coming out, and it's being, quote, perfected, as appalling as it is. And with totally a straight face, there's not even the slightest hint of what's up with this. What's going on? Where are we going here? It's just great. Yeah, it can do all these things. It can have various facial expressions, and yeah, you can pretend like you're in some kind of contact with society, with somebody else, and even if it's just a machine, and you know it is. Well, here's a couple of possible sort of antidote kind of things. There was a piece in the Times a few days ago which had to do with raves. And with techno music, trance music, whatever it's called, and how this is basically a piece about how, and it's the same thing here, the same thing in a lot of places, it's pretty much illegal. So people in the middle of the night are chasing around in the countryside with the cops after them and prowling around and trying to have a place for some big outdoor rave, you know, because they're basically illegal. And in fact, English law, it says here, there is a law, it's called the Criminal Justice and Public Order Act of 1994. This is the first time art specifically has been banned, and it says, for this purpose, music, quote, includes sounds wholly or predominantly characterized by the emission of a succession of repetitive beats. In other words, this part of it is actually making techno illegal. I mean, that's as crazy as that sounds. But here's the thing. This is what I thought was the most interesting here about the rave thing. And I've never been to one, but this may be kind of a key thing here. It says, the music was relentless, deliberately inhuman. The sound of a world accelerating towards some unimaginable mechanized future. Yeah, it's just kind of almost like they're inoculating themselves. They know full well what it is, what it means, where the world is going. I mean, that's what I could never get. And where I've been, like at some club, like overseas, and people are way into it. That's all they play for hours and hours. And it's just like a factory. It's just mechanical beat. It's just, why would people get off on it, you know? And anyway, I found that kind of illuminating. With maybe a little hint of kind of resistance in there. And here's something by John Schwartz, middle of last week in the tech section of the New York Times, of course. It's called Who Needs Hackers? And actually, I read a similar thing in Mondo 2000, the hacker zine, sort of along these lines. Anyway, the point here is simply what the subtitle says, the biggest threat to increasingly complex systems may be the systems themselves, and because they get more vulnerable, they become more. Everything is dependent on so many more parts that are increasingly more complex and interdependent, and it's all automated. And so one thing happens, and the whole thing starts going haywire. So, anyway, the point is, yeah, hackers can mess things up, but. But wait, this is gonna just start unraveling, and that's been said before too. But it gave this a kind of prominent place in the New York Times, so it isn't just wishful thinking. Some people would write it that way, like, oh yeah, it's gonna definitely come down, you know, like the peak oil people. It's, oh yeah, oil is gone, you know, and. Absolutely no way the system can survive, and they know, you know, they just go up and down about how that's for sure, you know, it's just certain. Like, remind me of the conspiracy theory people. They have the absolute answer, even though they don't. I mean, nobody knows. Well, one other thing I wanted to mention, this is on a different topic, and this is a piece, and I'm not going to go into this great length or anything here, but Wolfie Landstreicher was going to be at the very recent edition of the annual Anti-Civilization Get-Together. It's kind of like one of Spain's answers to the Feral Visions thing here. And he was invited, and he was going to give a talk or a workshop on the theme of kind of anti-primitivist anti-civilization. In other words, We're anti-civilization, but we ain't no primitivists, and various people have said that, and I've referred to that before. And he kind of bailed toward the last minute, and but he's posted the article. It's kind of a fairly brief article where he lays this out once again, actually. And he's got something to say here. I think this is a little more. Well, it's a little more sophisticated. I'm not sure it's any more viable or cogent. Some of it kind of lost me. One thing in particular, I'm just going to grab this out kind of at random. You know, he says, well, I talk to primitivists and ask them why they're into it, and a lot of them refer to desire. It's how I try to travel down the road of realizing my desires, and, you know, along those. And he said, well, that's kind of a reified way to look at it, you know, desires, you know, what. It's really struck me as quite ironic because that has been the stock in trade for Wolfie for decades, over and over. My untrammeled desire, my subjective passion, in fact, that's the very argument that he's generally made about primitivism. You don't need any reference to how people used to live. Don't have to have any interest in that whatsoever. You don't want to, don't go there to learn anything, because all you have to do is respect and go forth on your desires, on your yearning for some immediate satisfying direction, and that's enough. You don't have to get bogged down with any of the rest. So I thought it was kind of strange for him to try to turn that around. Because when you think of it, and don't get me wrong here, I'm already anticipating a flaming reaction here, but in terms of passions being unleashed and my subjectivity knows no limits and immediate desire and everything, well, you know, I can show you fascists who wrote along those lines in the 20th century, as far as that goes. And right away I'm saying, I want to tell you, there is zero reason to put Wolfie in there, okay? I'm not saying he's a fascist in any way at all. I'm just making the point that if you want to talk about desire and its limitations, that would be one place you could go, because it sounds great. It just sounds like this passionate stuff, which is why some of these movements had this radical appeal to youth. They simply did in Germany and in other countries, because they spoke this kind of language. I mean, you could take out sections and say, wow, that's they're breaking through. They're against the bourgeois world and everything else, and they don't want to compromise with this setup. Well, not exactly. So you do want to have, I think what you have, in my opinion, with primitivism is you have a desire to pay attention to the actual record and analyze the actual institutions that are part of the train or the inner logic that have brought us exactly to where we are now. And if you want to just ignore all that, I don't get why you'd want to do that. I mean, that's something that's there, and I think you can get something out of it. And and he actually says, this is another related point, I think, related to what I just said anyway, that he says it's a reification, he's using that word again, of the actual lived relationships of people, native people, indigenous people, for example, here, to use them in some sort of primitivist way, because that dehumanizes and de-individualizes those real people who had those experiences or those relationships. Well, that's why would you leap to that conclusion? Why would that be necessarily so at all? You could say that about anything. Let's not learn about anything, because that would be de-individualizing it out of its real living context. But nobody's saying that we are, say, Native Americans, except some middle-class wannabes who are embarrassingly, non-radical all the way around. But that certainly doesn't describe any anarchist primitivists I know. So I don't know who he's talking about or why he's so opposed to trying to see what people actually did. How did they survive? Would that not be useful? You know, what relationship did they have? You don't, why would you be hostile to trying to get into that and trying to draw something from it for possible use? It's kind of beyond me. And I think, quite frankly, the real bottom line is there are a lot of people who say they're anti-civilization, but it just sort of gives it away in their how much antipathy they have and how much time they spend attacking, quote, primitivism, which to me, quite frankly, and maybe this is a crude way to put it, but that is taking anti-civilization seriously, that general term, and as we generally understand. Well, Ant is on hand, and I'm happy that he's going to do something. So we'll go out with this reading and close off for now.
Hi. This is about a letter which Rachel Carnes wrote to the Eugene Independent. I'm sorry, the Eugene Weekly, June 28, 2007. Her article is entitled "These Are My Tools," and it's about a presentation given at the Eugene Public Library by Sergeant Lisa Barong, who is a police officer for the Eugene Police Department, and makes presentations to I guess to public schools and various venues. And Rachel Carnes took issue with a number of things. The tools of her trade, the police officer's job, as she put it, were her uniform, her radio, her badge, her police ID, and then she displayed other tools such as her spray, her pepper spray, and her nightstick, and her handcuffs, and then finally her gun. And as Rachel Carnes states in the letter, she said that the good people must be protected from the bad people and by these tools. And quite a few people apparently had left the room at that point when the police officer started displaying and discussing her tools. People left the room with their children. And the police officer said, among other things, she's quoted here as saying, "In America, being a police officer is one of the few jobs you can have where you get to carry a gun," unquote. And Rachel Carnes, instead of leaving the room, decided to stay and respond. And I think she made some very powerful points with her article, although I don't agree with everything, but I respect her courage for staying and making these points. And she was concerned, among other things, that the police officer may have preempted her right to choose when and how to discuss violence and the use of force with very young children. As she says, it's an intensely personal and private matter for families. And her daughter now has fresh new fears about the world, courtesy of Officer Barong, as she stated, and that these were very little children, baby children. So my response to her letter is the following. Thank you, Rachel Carnes, for your open letter to the mayor and to the citizens of Eugene, Oregon, who by their own default and descent into voluntary apathy, timidity, and fear, have given over their rights as citizens, as humans, to the bureaucrats and the corporate security guards of this world, and are thereby citizens invisible, citizens in name only. In your letter, Rachel, you spoke of choices and the right of a parent to choose when and how to inform her children about the harsh world of policemen and policewomen and their dangerous country of good people and bad people. We are in urban America, where law enforcers can be lawbreakers, where a uniform, a badge, a gun, and a government paycheck can and will preempt your right to make choices, even in the sanctity of your own family. America is a high-violence area where the future of your own beautiful children, their health and sanity, is purchased without a guarantee. Perhaps there is an implicit sanctity in every citizen's theoretical right to choose, the right to choose as a subject of this great empire, America, which includes an entire subset of everyday unrecognized rights, including the right to choose which landlord to pay rent to choose which gas station to fuel car with, choose which superstore to buy food from, choose which form of incarceration to send one's children to, known as public or private school, choose what brand of clothing to dress oneself and one's children in. Yes, the right to choose also includes these choices: the choice to buy and the choice to be sold, choice to consume and the choice to be consumed, the choice to produce and to be produced, the choice to waste and to be wasted, the choice to ask permission to be permitted to be licensed, and the choice to be denied, to be prohibited, and to be outlawed. There is also the right to choose to leave the room with one's children, or to choose to speak up when a policewoman tells us her truth about every day's and every night's use of power, according to the ABCs of law enforcement taught to her in every briefing room and police academy of Comic Book America, a high-violence area where the good people and the bad people share a common destiny under tyranny. Finally, there is a primary right to choose. Perhaps the primary right at the start of every citizen's lifetime of choices in a world of organized violence where civility floats in armored vessels over an ocean of punishment, deprivation, and pain. Consider this primary right, which is a mother and father's right to choose when and how to tell the truth or to tell lies to their children. In a scary world, there is scary truth, and around the fear and fire of truth are always the lies of power. The words from a policewoman's mouth are true from the point of view of authority made by lies and power. Sooner or later, children will know this world. Perhaps a mother and father can show strength, patience, and kindness as the antidotes for punishment and pain. Our ancestors, the ancestors of every human being, had in their tool bags of needs and abilities certain tools for survival. Some of these tools included thirst and hunger, curiosity and learning, fear and sadness, anger and love. Save one, save them all. Deny one, deny them all. Use one, use them all. Lose one, lose them all. Perhaps we may protect our children not by shielding them from fear, but by showing them how to use fear as our ally, as our gift, one among many, to protect the original inheritance and our elusive sanity of both parent and child, in order, as Lauren Isley wrote, to outlast all fierce pursuits.
Hey, thanks much, Aunt. Great commentary. Okay, I guess we're just gonna play some music and make way for Kim. See you later.